The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Heretics Hour on Monday, August 12, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm going to be bringing you a good program tonight. Well, I think it's a good program, and I kind of think you will think so, too. My topic is lies, once again, lies of the enemy, both back in the 1940s against Germany, and still today, and still aimed at Germany, at preventing Germany from returning to nationalism. You know, if there are any signs of life in the German population towards nationalism, it would be big news all over the world, and everyone would be very interested in it. And that's why they do all they can to prevent it. On Saturday, I talked about Carlos Porter's newly published book, War Crimes Trials and Other Essays, which can be ordered from Lulu or Amazon and probably other places, too. But I don't know. I didn't check any more out. But it doesn't cost too much. But I was only able to cover the first essay on Saturday, which I thought I would do more, which leaves me some of it to do tonight. And tonight I'm going to only cover one other essay in the book, which is the one titled War Crimes Trials, which is pretty detailed. Excuse me, all of a sudden I'm getting some hiccups. Then I'll go on to the National Socialist Underground Terrorist Trial, terrorist in quotes, or terrorist neo-Nazi trial, whatever. You know, how they're portraying it. That's taking place right now, today, in these days, this year, in Munich, and draw parallels from then to now. I'm not going to be drawing exact parallels about, you know, like the trial testimony, but I will be drawing some parallels. And if some people decide they want to call in and bring something up about that, then, it might inspire some ideas in my mind about some of the parallels between them. The number is 1-830-443-4911, but that won't be until the second hour, please. But before I get started on this, I did see a story this morning that just got me going, you know, just made me so irritated and angry. It's about a magazine group in Australia. This story came from the Daily Telegraph in Australia. It's .com. I don't know. It's not the Telegram from United Kingdom. It's the Daily Telegraph, and it's from Australia. But they wrote that there's this what they call is an Australian company, but it's German-based media corporation, Bauer Media Group. It oversees some Australian publications and some well-known magazines. It's a big magazine company. This company was accused of celebrating heroism. I'm not going to put it that way. I'm going to put it the way it was in the article, that they came under fire for appearing to glorify Adolf Hitler's soldiers during World War II. Guess who it is that made this charge against them? None other than that little worm, that piece of insect dung that one of the most disgusting, the person, if you want to think in terms of the biological Jew, I mean, there's a good example that you might use to bolster your argument for there being the biological Jew. And that's Abraham Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League in the United States. And, this idea that has been going on since the end of the war, that Hitler's soldiers cannot be honored, that the German soldiers of World War II cannot be honored and must be ignored or somehow, you know, just, they, well, left on the sidelines. And no monuments or anything have ever been built in Germany for their World War II soldiers. This is one of the most disgusting ideas. One of the most, really, this morning I came up with lots and lots of adjectives to use, but I'm a little worried now I might say something I shouldn't, so I'm stopping myself from just letting go. But this is truly a shame on Germany to allow this to go on. And it's people like Foxman and many, many others who keep this alive and keep pushing this. Of course, it goes without saying that the German World War II soldier was one of the best soldiers ever in the history of the world. And they were wonderful men and fathers and husbands and sons and full of patriotism. And they had died by many hundreds of thousands in Russia. And they have been left there because nobody went and looked for them and took care of them. And now finally there's a wonderful organization in Germany made up of Germans. And I didn't go and check its the correct name. It's something to do with the German cemetery organization or something. And they have made a great effort over the years to bury so many of these soldiers from the war. And now they've made lots of cemeteries in Russia too. They couldn't do it until after the 1990 until all that changed. And now Russia is allowing them to come in there and find these corpses and identify them and bury them. And they have these cemeteries set up, German cemeteries set up in Russia now. And of course they're in Germany too. They're in the Eastern Europe. They've done a lot of work on this, but I don't want to go on about that. But this crumb bag, it's going after this magazine group, and they have three publications. One is called History and Knowledge. I'm just going to use the Geschichte und Wissen. And then the other one, Militär und Geschichte, Military and History, and Der Lanzer, which is like the countryman, Lanzer is one of your fellow countrymen, someone of your own country, which is supposed to be a private magazine. But these three have been cited by this letter writer, Foxman. He sent his letter to the German government in February, it says. He says that he's called a Holocaust survivor. Now, this is really the worst part of it. This man calls himself a Holocaust survivor because it says, I know he does, but it also says here in this letter, which has been made public, the Holocaust survivor referenced the magazine's portrayal of key Nazi figure Hermann Göring and Leni Riefenstahl, the film director. These two are what bothered him, that they were shown in a nice way or, some flattering way. And it says, he calls himself, he's saying that he's a Holocaust survivor, so he has a right to be offended by all this. This man, as a baby, can you imagine him as a baby, Abe Foxman? As a baby, he was given up by, he was, a Christian family was asked by his Jewish parents to take him in, because they didn't know what might happen. Well, as it turned out, his Jewish parents were still around after the war, and I don't think that they were even in a camp. I don't know where they were, but they went and claimed, went back to get him after the war, and the Christian family gave him up, to him. And so there he was reunited with his parents. But I imagine after 4 years, he was starting to show us how he looked, and they're probably happy to turn this guy back over to his parents. I just would like to see what he looked like as a little boy. Anyway, it says that the poor German government responded. And it doesn't say who, it just says the German government. I'm very suspicious of this kind of stuff. They vowed to monitor the publications. Well, it didn't say they were going to close them down, they're just going to monitor them. But they may have just said this as, you know, what you have to say to satisfy these creeps like Foxman and the Simon Wiesenthal Center people too. They said the content is repulsive. The content of those publications is repulsive, and combating anti-democratic extremism has always been the highest priority of the German government. Anti-democratic. Well, you know, we're going to find out what kind of, I mean, I'm going to be talking a bit tonight about what kind of democracy and what kind of democratic way of thinking they have in Germany today. And Foxman welcomed the response. And here's a statement he put out. The issue of free speech is complex. I should talk like him a little bit more. He has this kind of grating voice. The issue of free speech is complex, but any glorification of the Nazi regime is simply unacceptable, Foxman said. And we welcome the commitment of the German government to maintain a vigilant eye on these publications and to take action if they cross the line. Well, a representative for the magazine group, Deborah Thomas, did not respond to the request for comment yesterday. Good for them and her. And it just says that, you know, what size this is, how they bought out another magazine group in Australia and became the largest magazine group in Australia. And they have 600 print publications worldwide focused on health, beauty, and gossip. But they just happened to probably have had these three magazines around for a long time that are not exactly like the rest of their stuff. But, you know, these military magazines are quite popular. They really are popular, and they have good pictures in them, too. So a lot of people like them. It would be a shame if they'd... why, if you have a military magazine, would you be unable to print stories and photographs of the German military? You know, you're talking about all other militaries. Why would that one not be? But see, that's what they want to do. That's what these creeps like Foxman, that's his job, to try to stomp out anything like that. Well, going on to Carlos Porter and his book, War Crimes Trials, and to the chapter. Let me just start out by saying that approximately, he says in there that there are about 10,000 war crimes trials that have been held since 1945. I find that amazing. I believe him. I'm sure he's looked into it, but that's a lot. I would never have thought. I only know about a few of them. And that includes the Japanese, too. Germans and Japanese and Eastern Europeans to date. So, yeah, he's keeping track. So I guess, you know, it's come up to 10,000. And he says almost invariably the charge is violation of the laws and customs of war. That's in particularly in at Nuremberg. Derived in turn from international conventions signed at The Hague in 1899 and 1907. Now that these trials have little or no basis in law is clear from the wording of the treaties, which are said to have been violated. Well, I'm reading from his book now, from this chapter, War Crimes Trials, and it is mainly about the Hague Conventions, and he says that what I just read. So he says, let's take a typical example, the Hague Declaration 4.3 of 1899. On the use of expanding bullets, which was in July 1899, and the convention states the contracting parties, agree to abstain from the use of bullets which expand or flatten easily in the human body, such as bullets with a hard envelope which does not entirely cover the core or is pierced with incisions. And he says, the present declaration is only binding, this is in the convention, is only binding for the contracting powers in the case of a war between two or more of them. It shall cease to be binding from the time when, in a war between the contracting powers, that is, the powers had to have signed the convention, signed the contract here. One of the belligerents is joined by a non-contracting power. So he says this is called an all-participation clause. So it's not binding unless all parties have signed on to it. And if two or a few parties go to war and they're all signatories, but then another party joins in and they include him in the as one of the belligerents, then it's no longer binding on anybody because it's not binding on this one party. And that's what was signed in 1899. Now, Carlos writes, the United States never ratified this convention. The U.S. didn't, this early one, which thus never became international law in any war involving the United States. This was because American troops were busy using expanding bullets against Filipinos, whom they had just liberated from the Spanish. Now, then the American refusal to ratify this convention meant not only that the United States was free to continue using expanding or dum-dum bullets legally in all wars, but from the moment the United States entered any conflict, all other belligerents were free to use them as well. And now this is important to keep in mind because this is the basis of what we're talking about with the Hague Convention and what we're talking about with what was used at the war crimes trials to convict these people of crimes that, you know, this they were going by what was signed at the Hague, and then also their own extra laws and treaties and agreements that they made prior to the end of the war, let's say starting in 1944, especially later in 1944, and in 1945, when the big three and so on met, you know, to discuss mainly how they were going to handle their victory, because they knew by then they were confident, even in 44, that their victory was at hand. And so then they decided how they would handle the Germans, how they would punish them, what they would do, and so on. And they made their own little rules then, after, you know, at that time that that Germany had never been a part of, or even they hadn't been a part of, and, you know, at the time some of these things happened. So you have to keep in mind that none of it is really has a really legal basis to it. So the United States had never signed this first convention, therefore was never held liable for any of it. Now, since 1907, there are 14 Hague conventions, almost all of which contain similar clauses, which is what that thing called the All Participation Clause. And for this reason, they have had little or no application since 1907. And that's because there was never all participation. See, they almost all of the conventions, each thing is called a convention. Well, there's 14 conventions, and the all of them, almost all of them, have this all participation clause that unless everybody in the war that's fighting in the war officially, you know, is has signed it, then it doesn't have any application. So generally it has not had. He says it has never had any application for that reason, since 1907, since it was signed. So going on, he says, the Fifth Hague Convention, respecting the rights and duties of neutral powers and persons in case of war on land, was from 18 October 1907, states in Article 20, The provisions of the present convention do not apply except between contracting powers, and then only if all the belligerents are parties at the convention. This convention was never ratified by Great Britain, Carlos says, and never applied after August 4th, 1914, because Britain was in the wars, starting with the beginning of World War I in August 1914, and so it didn't apply to anybody. Now, just these are just examples. Article 1 of this Fifth Hague Convention says the territory of neutral powers is inviolable. All right. Nevertheless, so you couldn't go into a neutral power. You could not, you know, you couldn't violate their territory. Nevertheless, Carlos says the British and Americans never tired of quoting this clause against the German and Japanese, despite their own violations of the neutrality of Iceland, Greenland, Persia, Iraq, Portuguese Timor, and the planned violations of Scandinavian neutrality. Now, going on to the these are just some preliminary examples. The Third Hague Convention was that of respecting the opening of hostilities. And Article 1 states the contracting powers recognize that hostilities between themselves must not commence without previous and explicit warning in the form either of a reasoned declaration of war or an ultimatum with conditional declaration of war. So, you know, you can't just, it was not allowed in these conventions of war to just all of a sudden, in a surprise move, attack someone. So you had to declare your intentions. You had to declare war on them in advance. The problem here is that the warning may be as little as 1 minute and no verbal formula is required. He says Poland received two ultimatums and was the first to mobilize. America received a formal declaration 25 minutes late, of which it had actual knowledge 10 days beforehand. However, the basis of nearly all war crimes trials has been the Fourth Hague Convention, respecting the laws and customs of war on land. The Fourth Convention. In the words of Telford Taylor, chief counsel and representative of the United States for the prosecution of war crimes at Nuremberg, and this is a quote, an annex to the convention, consisting of 56 articles, sets forth various requirements and limitations with respect to the conduct of hostilities, the treatment of prisoners of war, and the exercise of authority over the occupied territory of a hostile state. This then, that's the end of the quote, this then is the convention which the Germans and Japanese were alleged to have violated in 10,000 trials. What does the convention say exactly? So this, it was this annex, which has 56 articles, that is really what sets forth the conduct that you have to follow. And it's really quite amazing to study this. It's not that nobody knows about it or hasn't read it before, but, you know, we tend to maybe forget, or we tend to lose sight of it. And when you really look at it, it's so black and white. It's so cut and dried that the Allies had no right to do anything that they did after the war. The Article 2 says, the provisions of the present convention do not apply except between contracting powers, and then only if all the belligerents are parties to the convention. So again, it's only between those who have signed it, and only if everybody who's fighting has signed it. This condition has remained unfulfilled since August 1st, 1914, he says. This has never been the case in any war since August 1st, 1914, which was the beginning of the war that became the First World War. Non-signatories during World War II included Italy, Greece, and the National States of Yugoslavia, Communist Russia, which repudiated all Tsarist agreements and never made any pretense of obeying the Hague or Geneva Conventions. Article 3, a belligerent party which violates the provisions of the said regulations shall, if the case demands, be liable to pay compensation. So this is that, you know, if you have violated any of these provisions, you are required to pay compensation to the other party, but you're not, it's not said that you're going to be put on trial as a criminal. You know, you're not put on trial as criminals. You simply have to pay costs. You know, pay what we call, what do we call that? And so, those are a few things. Now, the annex to the Fourth Hague Convention has the following stuff. The annex to the convention was the real basis for nearly all of these 10,000 trials. This is the convention which defines war crimes and war criminals. All right? Articles 1 and 2 prohibit guerrilla warfare, stating that belligerence must be commanded by a person responsible for his subordinates. Have a fixed distinctive emblem recognizable at a distance, carry arms openly, and conduct their operations in accordance with the laws and customs of war. So this is saying that guerrilla warfare is illegal, and anybody who is sponsoring or helping with that is in the wrong. And you have to have a commander that's a responsible person. He's responsible for his subordinates. You can't just have fighters running around, you know, without knowing who, you know, without somebody overseeing them and being responsible for them. Excuse me. And you have to carry your arms openly and show that you're fighting. You know, you've got weapons to use, and you. So that's it. So Carlos says the European and Asian. Also, he includes the Japanese war too in this. But I'm sort of skirting around that. These resistance movements were all illegal. Article 43 of the Annex requires collaboration with occupation governments. This one is really interesting because it says the authority of the legitimate power having in fact passed into the hands of the occupant, the latter shall take all the measures in his power to restore and ensure as far as possible public order and safety while respecting, unless absolutely prevented, the laws and force of the country. In other words, once you occupy a place or you set up your own occupation government, this is a legitimate power. And this legitimate power is passed into the hands of the occupying, force or the representative of that. And they shall restore and ensure public safety. The whole thing about these conventions at that time was that there was a big distinction between the military forces and the civilian population, and the idea then was that since there were nations with national boundaries and so on, and national identities and national sovereignty, when nations had disputes. And they couldn't seem to straighten them out or come to an agreement about their dispute. Sometimes it came to war, and war was not considered wrong or bad. That came later with this big liberal thing that suddenly nobody has a right to go to war, unless you're the most powerful nation in the world, then you can't. But you know that war was accepted as the final way to settle disputes, but it was they wanted to put rules around it so that it would, you know, be a little more civil, not civil, but, you know, a little more wild, you know, under some, makes sense. And what they had to do was ensure that the civilian population had, could live in a measure of order and safety, and that this war would not, disruption and so on would break out, you know, and interfere with people's, with the life of the civilians. And the military was very much distinct, you know, and they went off and did their war thing, but it wasn't supposed to affect the civilians in their everyday life, you know. So that's what this is based on, I think, that if you have taken over a country and you need to restore order and you need to make sure that there's public safety, and if people like these resistance type people are interfering with that or not accepting that and are fighting and doing, you know, blowing things up and so on, then you have to come down on these people and enforce this. And they have to respect your authority. And they're in the wrong when they don't respect your authority. They're the ones who are in the wrong. The collaborators, I think this is... Porter saying the collaborators shot, hanged, or imprisoned after World War II were acting in compliance with international law. Well, he was saying, you know, when they shot, hanged, and imprisoned, I know what he's saying here. He's saying that those who were accused of collaborating with the enemy and were punished for it, even by being shot and hung and so on, hanged and imprisoned, that was wrong, because these collaborators were the ones who were in compliance with international law and not the other way around. But see how they romanticized and glorified the resistance people after the war and punished those who followed the law and did what they were supposed to do. And we're very, very confused about that today, because we don't understand it. We don't understand what the rules of war were at the time. And they've just been changed to suit, changed in the minds of people to suit the powers that be. Now, Article 23.3 prohibits weapons calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. So that was outlawed, but, you know, Porter says napalm, phosphorus, jellied gasoline, etc., are all illegal. And the British started using phosphorus bombs in World War II. And I don't know, I guess the Americans started using them too, or were they all from the British? I have to check that out. Can't say that for sure at the moment, but they certainly did use them. We'll get into more of that later. Article 25, 27, and 56 prohibit bombardment by whatever means of undefended cities, cultural monuments, etc. Well, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is the fire bombings of Dresden and the civilian areas of Hamburg. And then he mentions Tokyo, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. I'm not going to get into that. But that was illegal. Those, what the English and Americans did, in those fire bombings, were illegal because they bombed undefended cities and cultural monuments. Well, I was going to say that all German cities, of a certain size were bombed, and some were very historic, but some of them were defended. They weren't very well defended, but I mean, they had, anti-aircraft guns set up, in most of the places. But it is known that in Dresden, there was no defense, and nobody expected that, and it shouldn't have happened. I mean, what I've just said so far about the conventions of war, you know, never should such a thing have happened as happened at Dresden. And it was so close to the end of the war, too, in February 45. So it was just pure barbarism. Anyway, it's clearly illegal, and they still that still hasn't been able to be enforced in the world today, although they know they have no defense for it. All right, going on to Article 6, we're in this annex still, the annex to the Fourth Convention. Article 6 states that belligerents may utilize the labor of prisoners of war, officers excepted, for the public service, for private persons, or of their own account. So it was perfectly legal to use the labor of your prisoners of war, but not the officers. That's pretty well understood. And the Germans did not use the officers, except like when things got so bad, they might have used officers at in Dresden for the Dresden cleanup because they were so furious. But generally, they didn't. And the public, they could use them for public service or even give them to private persons to work there, or just wherever they wanted them to work. And so this idea that there was this slave policy of putting these people to work was again legal, insofar as it applied to members of resistance groups or lower ranking military personnel, not the higher ranking personnel. Article 8 states that prisoners of war are subject to the laws, regulations, and orders in force of the state in whose powers they are. Any act of insubordination justifies the adoption towards them of such measures of severity as may be considered necessary. So when you are a prisoner of war, you are subject to the laws and regulations, etc., and orders that are in force in the state in whose who has captured you and made you, you know, a prisoner of war. And you have no right to be insubordinate. You have no right to refuse to cooperate. And if you do, it's okay to treat you severely in order to counter your insubordination. So this romantic idea that these soldiers or whatever could act up, you know, and so on. And if they were punished, that so bad of the Germans who punished them. No, that was all perfectly legal. They were the ones that were out of order. They were the ones in the wrong. And so again, he says, so much for the mistreatment of prisoners, which formed the basis of so many war crimes trials. Well, you know, this mistreatment of prisoners, they would exaggerate anyway, and they would make things up, and they would make it out to be worse or different than what it really was. When they were just being disciplined, they would make out like they were being, you know, punished for no reason whatsoever. And here we have, reminds me that Abe Foxman can call himself a Holocaust survivor today, when he was never in any kind of a camp, or he was never any kind of a prisoner. He was an infant, if you can imagine him ever being an infant, who was in the house of a kindly Christian family until after the war, and then he was handed back to his parents. But, he was suffered from the Holocaust. He's a survivor because he happened to be there in the area where that was supposedly going on. That's how the Jews have managed to define Holocaust survivor. If you were living in that certain large area that they consider the Holocaust was going on, if you were just living there as a Jew and you maybe had to, you know, change your name, or maybe you didn't, you tried to stay lay low, or maybe you you even hid yourself or something for a while. Well, then you're a Holocaust survivor, even though nothing ever happened to you. Okay, back to this. Article 46. Private property cannot be confiscated. Carlos says the post-World War II expulsions and confiscations were illegal. Of course they were. And even the Versailles Treaty was illegal because this was, they confiscated all kinds of land and property and gave it to somebody else. But it says that in the convention that you can't confiscate people's private property. So, let's see, he says that, the provisions of the Versailles Treaty, which confiscated the private property of all German citizens resident outside Germany, including missionaries on South Sea Islands, who were expelled and sent home penniless, were illegal. Now, I don't have any real knowledge about that, I trust that he does. Now, Article 5 says prisoners cannot be confined except as an indispensable measure of safety and only while the circumstances which necessitate the measure continue to exist. And Article 20, after the conclusion of peace, the repatriation of prisoners shall be carried out as quickly as possible. So you can't hold these people. You can't confine people except for their own safety. And after the conclusion of peace, you have to send them back as quickly as possible. Well, we know that didn't happen. And that is one of the greatest wrongs of the Allies in how they treated people, and particularly the Germans after the war. And Porter says a prolonged detention of German and Japanese prisoners by the British, French, Russians, and Americans for years after the war was illegal. And of course, it says though at the conclusion of peace, but there was no peace concluded with Germany. That in itself is not allowed to be, but the Germans were forced to go along with it because they had no choice, you know. They could remain without their own government and, you know, with the U.S. Running their country, or they could have some semblance of running their own country and having their own voting and having their own leaders and so on, which they chose to do. In order to have that, they had to go along with that there would be no peace treaty. They had no friends on that score. Nobody stood up for them. Who stood up for the Germans after the war? Nobody. So when you're totally alone and friendless, you don't have much choice but to make the best deal you can. So there still is no peace treaty with Germany. A lot more, you know, people try to bring that up, but it doesn't go very far. But to move on with Article 7, prisoners of war shall be treated as regards board, lodging, and clothing on the same footing as the troops of the government who captured them. Well, we're pretty familiar with that, but Porter brings up Eisenhower's death camps, saying they were illegal because they weren't treated the same. But, you know, Eisenhower got around that by changing the status of those soldiers from prisoner of war to disarmed enemy, personnel? Disarmed enemy personnel. So they were still enemies, and they were disarmed, but they didn't come under the label of prisoners of war, so they didn't have to treat them that way. So he got away with that. But, of course, it's wrong in spirit. Terribly wrong. That's another horrible crime that has still not been dealt with. Article 32, a person is regarded as a parliamentaire who has been authorized by one of the belligerents to enter into communication with the other, and he has a right to inviolability. That is, you know, if someone from one of the belligerent nations is authorized to go and enter into communication with the other, with another belligerent nation, he cannot be violated. But, and this brings up Rudolf Hess and his flight to England, and he said he was coming as a, you know, as a messenger, something of peace. He was going to wanted to talk about working out some peace between the nations, but it was a bit too unexpected. So, you know, he didn't seem to have any authorization either. So it's a little bit tricky there. But they still, it's still, everybody knows they had no right to arrest him and hold him as though he was an enemy agent, because it's clear he wasn't. And then they held him until he died, you know, or was killed, was murdered, until he's 90. So it's just, but this shows that if he came to communicate, although they get around that because of, probably because he didn't have, he didn't have the authorization. Anyway, Article 23 prohibits declaring abolished, suspended, or inadmissible in a court of law the rights and actions of the nationals of a hostile party. That is, you can't abolish or suspend or make inadmissible in the law court the rights and actions of the nationals of the party you feel hostile toward. That's you can't make that declaration. And Porter says, if these treaties have any application at all, which is doubtful, the real war criminals were the Americans, the British, the French, and the Russians. Because they abolished the rights of the Germans in the court. They didn't have any rights. They suspended them. They made everything inadmissible. I don't know if this is part of this or something different, but the illegalities, let's see where I am here. Okay. The illegalities of war crimes proceedings include the admissibility of oral and written hearsay, the introduction of the concept of conspiracy into international law, which was unknown prior to 1945, the total lack of any pretrial inquest or forensic evidence, and trial before a court itself composed of actual war criminals. Well, this does relate to this Article 23. That if you make, that oral and written hearsay is inadmissible, but they admitted it, you know, they made it admissible. And they introduced the concept of conspiracy in the war crimes trials, which into international law, which was unknown prior to 1945. It had never been a concept of that nature. And they there was no pretrial inquest or any forensic evidence looked into. They didn't have to check any of this stuff out. To see whether it whether it was worth bringing into the courtroom. And there was, and the trial before a court itself. Okay, well, so he's saying that, that the court itself was composed of war criminals. You know, the Americans, the British, the French, and the Soviets were all, it was a court composed of war criminals accusing others, their enemy, of being war criminals. So, to return to the writings of Telford Taylor, Porter says, and this is another quote from Telford Taylor, the issues surrounding the war crimes trials are numerous and complex. discussion and criticism of what was done should be welcomed by all who hope for a continuing development of international law. But what should have been done instead is a problem generally ignored by those who condemn what was done in fact. Okay, Taylor is trying to take the position that it's okay to criticize what happened, but nobody says what should have been done instead. You know, what should, well, I suppose they don't have a chance and nobody would publish it and nobody would listen to it if they did. But Porter says, has an answer for that, and he says the alternative is a fair trial before an impartial court under existing procedures and proper rules of evidence. That is to do it right instead of what they did. That's what should have been done. And the outcome, if that had been done, the outcome would be totally different. Well, last Saturday I was going to, I was sorry that I didn't get this little item in about Himmler's Posen speech. And it's somewhere in the book. I read it, Porter talked about this speech, which is Himmler's, the famous speech where supposedly Himmler admits and tells his, the SS officers he's speaking to, that there's an ongoing program to exterminate the Jews, which everybody here knows about, but we don't talk about it. You know, he was saying something like that in this Posen speech, which is questionable to begin with. In fact, I think the questions about this speech are so serious, the questions as to its authenticity, is that I think it should not be accepted as authentic. You know, a lot of these things, they have a whole bunch of it sounds so good. It sounds so much like that person would say. It sounds so Himmlerish in this case. But then they stick something else in there. And then that just makes it harder to deny the whole thing because you say, well, sounds like him, you know. But in any case, even if he did, if which I don't really think, but if he did make this speech, which is kind of crazy that he would, if this was a big secret and that nobody was going to talk about it, that he actually mentioned it in a speech, which was being recorded. Yeah, it was being recorded. It wasn't just on typewritten, you know, hadn't just been typed out and there was a typescript of it. There was also a recording of it, which they say they've listened to, and people have said that it didn't really sound like Himmler and it's very bad quality, and the Germans had very good quality audio recordings. They wouldn't have had bad quality. But in any event, what Porter said in this item, which I couldn't find today, but I remembered what he said. The whole question is about the word Ausrottung, which means, they say it means extermination. So that's the word that he used for what was happening with the Jews was Ausrottung, A-U-S-R-O-T-T-U-N-G, which means extermination, and Ausrotten, A-U-S-R-O-T-T-E-N, means to exterminate. And he, looking up that word, well, Porter said that his choice of in translating that word would not be extermination, would be extirpate. Well, so I looked up Ausrottung, and the choices it gives are extinction, eradication, extermination, extirpation, and excision. And then I looked up Ausrotten, to exterminate, and it was to extirpate was the first choice in this one, extirpate. To exterminate or to extermine, to wipe out, to kill off, to stamp out, to render extinct. And then I looked up extirpate is an English word, and it has three choices here, main choices. One, to pull up by the roots. Two, to destroy totally, exterminate, or abolish. Three, to remove by surgery, or like to cut out, you know, to cut out from the where it's part of and remove it from the from that larger organism that it was a part of, that it was in. Porter is saying he likes the, he would choose the word extirpate. And really, all of these words can and have been explained that they were used in Germany as to get rid of something, you know, which doesn't mean to murder it, to, you know, just to talk about the Jews in the sense that we're going to extirpate them, let's say. We're going to pull them up by the roots. That is, we're going to get rid of all Jewish influence in our country. You know, we're just going to get it out of our area. You know, we're not going to tolerate any of it. We're going to get it out, and or to remove it, you know, as if by surgery. And the other, even to destroy totally or even to exterminate, can be to exterminate it in your society, or we have to wipe it out, to stamp it out, or to even to render it extinct, to make it not, there no longer. This, of course, to the Jews is horrible, horrible. It is murder to the Jews. But and of course they've convinced people that that's what the intention was. But it really wasn't, I don't think, because it's just impossible to do. The whole thing seems to be impossible to do. But that's a question that really should be, even if it's debated by a number of intelligent people, you kind of don't go anywhere with it. But that is the end of the first hour, ladies and gentlemen, and I finished all of this, and I'm going to be moving on to the NSU trial when we get back from our break. This is Monday, so we've got that great music by Frank Reneke. I just see you in 5 minutes.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken, im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken, und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als sie. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt, was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Und welche Erbärmlichkeit!
Welcome back, listeners, and this is Carolyn Yeager, and you're listening to the Heretics Hour on August 12th, 2013. And we've been talking about a little bit more from Carlos Porter's book, War Crimes Trials, this time about the Hague Conventions, and how everything that the Germans did was legal. And they are very careful to follow the law, and the idea that they were committing crimes, and war crimes and illegalities and so on is falsehoods and fibs and lies, made up by the, victorious powers after the fact. And they were the ones actually who were, you know, for example, supporting the resistance movements in, let's take the example of France, which the British were clearly supporting with money and training and personnel and every kind of support were supporting the so-called resistance fighters in France. And these people are projected as heroes and so on. But they were illegal, and that was an illegal thing to do. And the Germans were perfectly in their rights. You know, if any occupation government was ever a well-regulated and a fair government, it was the German occupation of France, and also the German occupation of Norway and Belgium and so on. These people didn't suffer, and these people didn't even mind it. But they were told, you know, that they should not say that and they shouldn't act like that, especially afterwards. But this French resistance stuff, and there were some Dutch resistance too, but they're mostly Jews who were in it. There are some that weren't too, because there's always some of these white people who join in with the Jews. Or they're communists, they're super liberals and so on. They're multiracialists and so on. They were in the wrong. They were clearly functioning illegally, and it was up to the Germans to enforce the law and enforce what they needed to enforce. And everything they did there was proper. And yet, even today, you know, it's being shown as atrocities and war crimes and so on. So, now today in Germany, we have this National Socialist Underground trial going on. And it's probably, well, I suppose there's been some big trials in Germany that have been given a lot of attention. And I didn't actually check into that to see what they would be. But this NSU trial is turning out to be something very big. Mainly, even though it may be that a lot of people don't pay attention to it, don't care, and don't even know about it, but it's a long running thing. You know, it's going to be a 3-year affair if they complete it when they say they're going to, which is a long time to have a trial going on. Well, the trial would be about two years and, a little less than 2 years. That's a long time to have a trial going on in a courtroom, right? But I'm going to go through the little bit of the history of it just briefly to put it into context here as to what it is and so on for those of you who might not be real sure. But the first victim was killed in September 2000. This is the way they write about it. This is not my writing. This is something from an article, the way they started it out. And the 10th victim was killed in April 2007. So that in a little less than only 7 years, well, does that mean 8 years, 2000 to 1, 2? No, 7 years, you know, these 10 people were killed. That's actually spaced out pretty good. Plus, nobody has been killed since 2007. And these were unsolved. They weren't able to solve why these people were killed or who killed them. And they suspected a kind of a mafia, which would have been, these were Turkish people, except for one Greek person. And then this, German, the 10th was this German, undercover agent or policewoman. And so they suspected, though, that it was a Turkish kind of a, you know, out kind of a crime mafia type thing going on, and that's where these killings were generated from. But then in 2011, something happened which broke all this open. And it was in November 4th, 2011, there was a bank robbery in Eisenach, which is in Thuringia, or maybe it's Thuringia. And at this, after this bank robbery, two men escaped on bicycles, it says, with a loot of 70,000 euros, which is $92,000. Now, the questions that come up to me, which I'll mention right now, which came up, you know, as I was going over this, where were the bicycles? Did they recover the bicycles? They say these two men escaped on bicycles. I read everything I could find on this, which is probably not everything because I only read what's in English, but I have never heard any mention that they have in evidence these bicycles, that they recovered these bicycles and they have these guys' bicycles. And I don't know what they did with all the money either, because I've never read anything about, that they recovered this money on these two guys that they have accused of being the bank robbers. So, in any event, after this bank robbery, it says that the police received valuable clues from vigilant witnesses. Well, that's just trying to say that, oh, they got help. But actually, it seems like what happened is that it says 2 hours after the robbery, police officers approached a suspicious caravan. Actually, it was like a van, you know, a travel van that you could sleep in and so on. Seen pictures of it. And this van suddenly went up in flames. Now, it's unclear whether these police officers were approaching it and they made themselves known that they're approaching it. And then the two guys inside learned that from that the police were surrounding them. And so they lit their van on fire and they then committed suicide. Because inside, the officers found the bodies of two men who had committed suicide. And they are identified as the neo-Nazis Uwe Mundlos and Uwe Bonhart, who had lived in hiding since the late 1990s. Well, they say these men had lived in hiding, and yet they have pictures of them at these right-wing festivals and outdoor meetings and so on. And they're sitting out there in the grass with other young people, and there's nothing, you know, they're just a group, I don't know what was going on there. Maybe they had speakers, maybe they had some music going on or something, and Beata Chapa is there too. Jape is there with them in some pictures. And they're sitting there amongst these other people. They're not hiding, but they keep going on and on about how they went underground. Well, I guess they were underground, but they weren't wanted for anything. You know, they weren't wanted for anything. So they didn't, they just had, I think they were using some alias names and so on and so forth. Now I'm not trying to say that they didn't do any of this stuff. I don't know. I'm not saying they didn't rob the bank, but I don't even see where the evidence is that they were the bank robbers. So, okay. So they found these two guys in this van. Now it has been speculated that they didn't even commit suicide, that they were murdered and, you know, and that van set on fire and then the police gave this story and so on. Anything is possible, but, I don't know where that comes from exactly, or whether there's any evidence for that. But you don't know how people are set up for things. But anyway, they found them, and they say that they committed suicide by one killed the other, and then killed himself. So they had a gun with them. However, the gun that's supposed to be the murder weapon that killed all these 10 people was found in a house in Zwickau, which was a house where they lived with Beata Chapa. And this house was 1 hour and 37 minutes driving distance between Eisenach, where they supposedly robbed the bank, and where they lived in Zwickau, an hour and 37 minutes. Well, that's not too far at all to drive to go and do a crime. They say that the reason that they put all this together was because in the same afternoon that this bank was robbed and they found these two guys dead in this burned van, this house that they lived in with Chapa burned after an explosion. It burned down. It was partially burned down in Zwickau. Now, it's kind of funny. Now, that also could have been done. You know, the whole thing could have been set up, but I think I'm not saying that because Chapa won't say anything. So she, you know, she hasn't said a word. Anyway, so they've got lots of neighbors and so on that have now said that they lived there, and it, Chapa was a nice lady, and these two guys were kind of quiet. Nobody knew him very well, but everybody knew Chapa because she liked to socialize with people. And they were just kind of a different group, it seemed. They thought that, well, she might have been, one of them was her boyfriend, and the other one, sometimes they said that one was her boyfriend and the other one was his brother, and they all lived together under those conditions. I'm just trying to look at evidence. And when they searched that house that was burned, they found a bunch of stuff, and they found this gun, which was a Seska model, the same. And they call it, they say it is the gun with which the policewoman Michelle Kieswetter was shot dead in 2007. You know, the 10th victim. That this was the gun that shot her. Now, the way this is written all the time is that have they proven that it's the exact same gun or the same model of gun? They say it's here that it was the gun. But they also had a gun with them that they shot themselves with in Eisenach after the police were coming after them, supposedly. So then they say that along with that gun that they found in there, they found a video. And the video was this Pink Panther video that some of you may have heard about. And that in this video, they claimed responsibility for these murders. But, you know, that's a lie. They didn't. They didn't claim responsibility in this video. It's a funny kind of a video that shows some images from news, from the news, after these murders, after these murders were discovered or after they happened, and there was some news footage. And then there was stuff about a pink, there was stuff from the Pink Panther cartoons, and there was stuff, there was a lot of stuff on there. Like maybe they just had a, every time they saw something they wanted to put on, put, you know, keep on a, on this video cassette, that they just put it on there. And so it was a mixture of stuff, but it certainly, there was certainly no claim of responsibility. Just because there were some of these news, partial news reports of some, or maybe two, or maybe it was more, but I only saw two of the murders when they took place, after they took place, that they said, they think that they, that's claiming responsibility, and it's not. So then it says they call this, they make a lot of this video called a macabre video, in which they claimed responsibility for a series of killings. You know, again, that's a lie. And the video was the, they call the video the first clue in uncovering these killings, which had let, which had been, you know, the German authorities had not been able to solve these for years, and they certainly wanted to. So then they suddenly realized that the murders of the 8 small business owners of Turkish origin and one Greek, so there was 8 Turks, one Greek, and then this German policewoman, that adds up to 10, were committed by this terror trio, which they named the National Socialist Underground. I guess this was on the video. I think on the video they mentioned National Socialist Underground. And they keep talking about how these 3 people were underground, had gone underground. I used to think that was just crazy, but I guess they were. I guess they did. They weren't out in the open as themselves. They were kind of using other names, and they got other, driver's licenses and identifications from people helped them to get that and so on. So they were doing something, but what, I'm not sure. Because I'm, you know, you look for the evidence, and it, you know, I'll just say right now that it seems as though they are having a heck of a time coming up with any evidence. And that's why they've increased the, they've lengthened the time where this, where they have to schedule court sessions. And as comes up a little bit later, they now have court sessions scheduled until December 2014, where it was supposed, the trial was supposed to be over in January 2014, but now it's been extended January, February. And, okay, now then what happened was that the government, the politicians, and the government of Angela Merkel immediately accepted that these, that this is what happened, and these were the killers of these Turks, and they immediately started making statements and accepting, you know, blame and so on for it in the name of the German people. And this is so similar to what goes on now in these fake events. Like 9/11, when George Bush immediately, within a couple of days, they had everything figured out. They knew who the culprits were, and George Bush is saying it and announcing it and so on in his speeches. And they just rush into this, and they start right away commiserating with the victims and talking about the victims and playing up the victims. And they did the same thing with these other events, let's say with with the Sandy Hook thing. You know, immediately they had the murderer. No, there was no investigation, really. And nobody saw anything either. I don't want to get into that, but that's still, we've never seen anything about that Sandy Hook murderer, so-called. Where's all those security cameras in the school? The brand new security system they had just put in there. Nobody's seen anything from it. And nobody cares either, because they're so busy talking about the victims. So that's the same thing they've done here. And Christian Wolff, the president at the time, I don't know if he's still the president. He's not the president anymore, no. But he was the president then. And he got up and condemned the crimes and described the horror. And he said, quote, "People in our country living among us means they were, which to me means they were not citizens but foreigners." He didn't say German people. He said people in our country living among us. Because I had wondered if any of these victims were had become citizens, but I think none of them were. Only the German woman. So they were all foreigners. They were immigrants. But he says, oh, they were made victims of deadly hate and right-wing violence. Well, that's not been proven. That hasn't been proven in a court of law yet, but he said that right off the bat. and how shocked he was. And this was only days after the NSU was announced to be even as existing. And he says, "We commemorate the dead and will hopefully now share the suffering with their many relatives." Yeah, that's, they go immediately to that. How fast. And this is the parallel of this with Nuremberg is kind of loose, but I mean it's that you're anybody who is a nationalist or who is a German patriot is blacklisted, you know, and is demonized, and the foreigners are exalted and loved. Anybody who's not an actual German but who is a foreigner, they are the ones who get the best attention and who should be given the love and support. And they say that you know, generally it's said that the motive was xenophobia and contemptuous racism. And they bring out that reports, this is the media in general, that the reports up until that time had used the tasteless and thoughtless term donor murders. I mean, from the time these things happened, starting in 2000 and ending in 2006, actually, because 2007 was that German woman. Policewoman, they called them donor. They started being labeled the donor murders. But donor, D-O-N-E-R with a umlaut over the O, is that's a Turkish kind of street food. It's a Turkish fast food that is popular, and even with the Germans, and they sell these, you know, because all these people were small businessmen, and that's putting it mildly. Small meaning, you know, they had these little stalls or a little bitty restaurants, not really a restaurant, but a little, you know, food place. This one was a flower seller. The last one who was shot, Simsek, he was a flower seller. He had this little, I don't know, little trailer-like thing. And then he would put his flowers and stuff out in front. You know, it just strikes me as being a front for some kind of crime organization. You know, I mean, I think that's what the investigators thought. And that they thought these men were all connected in some way with organized crime, which goes under a Turkish organized crime in Germany, because there's lots of crime that is it is by the Turks and of the Turks and for the Turks and just Turks involved. And among themselves, there'd be stuff going on, and they thought that these men were shot for whatever reason. Like, they, you know, the mafia type thing comes out and shoots people when they don't do what they wanted them to do or whatever, or they're not cooperating the way they want, or who knows, maybe they're working for the other. Maybe there's, you know, there's, you know, once there's opposite gangs, like, you know, that that compete with one another, and all of this, but they couldn't solve them. I don't know how much they cared to solve them, but they couldn't solve them. And it's to me, it's quite understandable that this is what they would think. But now they're trying to say that, oh, we were so cruel to the Turks, to our Turkish visitors who live among us. Now, if these people are coming to work for labor, what kind of work? What kind of this businesses they're running? How important were they to Germany, to a labor force? They're not a part of a labor force. They're running these little crummy little businesses that nobody needs, except that other Turks there buy their wares. Or maybe they were just crime fronts, like I said. Because who could make a living like the flower seller? I really wonder how he made a living for a big family, all his kids, selling flowers out of his little trailer thing there, his little hut. I would, you know, I questioned that a lot. So, but they want to make out now that, oh, they were treated, we were so horrible, we Germans, because we didn't take them seriously, and we didn't suspect right-wing murderers and killers right away. We should have suspected right-wing terrorism and racism and so on. And of course, this is promoted by the German media itself as a sign of the internal or inherent German racism. Germans are just racist, and they need to get over it. You know, we need to put on some more sackcloth and ashes and beg forgiveness from these foreigners for our attitudes. So instead of, you know, to cover up the lack of evidence and so on that the apologies began, and the ceremonies and the commemorations, again, so similar to 9/11 and other of these events here in the United States. Ceremonies and commemorations and media stories galore about the right-wing murderers, you know, always. And then portraying these Turkish nobodies as martyrs and heroes. While, as I said, German shame was discussed ad nauseum. And eventually, they've even built monuments, incredibly, to these Turkish nobodies who weren't citizens or anything, who had come into the country and were not doing anything productive except having kids, you know. And they were, now every city where a death took place, and oh, they're all, it's in big cities, you know, Nuremberg, Hamburg, Heilbronn, there's several, there's others that you recognize immediately. In each city where one of these murders took place, they have put up a big monument, and some of them may not have got their monuments up yet, but they're going to, and some of them do, and they're big too. And they have the name of every one of these 10 people on it, and their date of birth and their date of death and so on, and some kind of inscription, and big, tall things in some very public place where lots of everybody would see it, you know, in the tourist section around the train stations in German cities and European cities are in the central, you know, the central train station is in this city center, which is the tourist area for these places, these cities, because that's where all the old stuff is. And so, where did I click something and almost lost my place? Okay, and there, so they've got these putting these big monuments up. I mean, I think I have written stories on my website about as much of it as I could. And I've a lot of it is taken from German media, and I add to it or I select from it and so on. But I've got quite a number of posts at carolynyeager.net, and I was checking out all of them. There's about eight or so now, I think. And if you go to carolynyeager.net, and up at the top on the banner to the right, there's a search window, and if you type in NSU trial, which is what I use, and they all came up. So that's a good wording to use, and you can check them if you want to. Now, naturally, they start up this murder case, this murder investigation. Well, they've got a prosecution. Right away, these people are guilty. Well, Beata Chapa turned herself in shortly after it was announced that she was, they were searching for her. And so after a few days, she went and turned herself in. And she talked a little bit to the police officers, and then she shut up after that. And they arrested her and put her in solitary confinement, and they gave her some court attorneys, and she seems to have a pretty good attorney. I don't know. I haven't seen them in action in court yet. I mean, they've been in action, but not actually. I don't know that they've done any cross-examination. I don't know how they do this in these German courtrooms. You know, they've got judges. They don't have a jury. And they're taking evidence, and her attorney is this guy named Heer, and then he was joined by another guy named Stahl, and then this woman joined them. Her name is Sturm, and they seem to be pretty good. I like this Heer. I like the way he looks. I like the expression on his face, and he wrote something about her too in the beginning. That was very, well, I guess he was interviewed after he took on the assignment to be her defense attorney, which is court appointed, but I liked the way he was talking. And they seem to be very serious about doing the best they can for her, knowing that everything is stacked against her. And she has decided, maybe at their, I don't know, it doesn't say ever if it's at their, advice, but probably they think that's the best thing for her too, is to not say a word. And so the other people who were arrested, they searched and searched and searched to find anybody else who was in the right-wing scene that could have possibly been involved, and they've got three of them. So all in all, there's four defendants, Chape and then this Rolf Wohlleben, who is a known figure amongst the NPD-type people, and then two others named Carsten S. and Holger G. And as I've written about, Carsten S. has testified, and it turns out his testimony doesn't amount to all that much, but they're trying to make a lot out of it because he says he gave them. He gave these two guys this Seska pistol with the silencer, which they didn't ask for the silencer, but that's the one, the pistol that they wanted, a German-made pistol is all, and he found this one, and it had a silencer, so he purchased it and gave it to them. But he turns out he's homosexual. And he spent all his time, I guess, in the courtroom sobbing. I mean, they've got some pictures of him. He's got his face all covered. You can hide your identity in Germany, if you want, if you're, you know, a witness or whatever. And so, he's got this big hood on all the time. And then they say he could hardly talk. His voice is breaking. He's sobbing and so on. It's ridiculous. And, turns out he left the right-wing scene in the eastern part of Germany there, where these people were living, in 2000, before these murders ever started, and he moved to Dortmund, and he's been working in an AIDS clinic. So, that's him. And then this Holger G has refused to testify, too, although he wrote out a statement, and he read his statement in court, and it doesn't say too much. And he says he doesn't, he knew these guys, and he helped them out a little bit, gave them some money and so on, and he knew Beta Chapa and so on. But he never knew anything, never heard anything about any terrorist activity or murder or anything like that. That's what he says. And then he shuts up, and that's all. So nobody's talking. So the fact that Chapa is not talking probably helps them to say, well, okay, we won't talk. And then the government has to prove their case, which is which they're going to have to. I think that they're coming up with, they're making things up, and they're saying things that aren't true, like with this video. And we just have to see as it goes along. Let me see what I've got written here. Chapa's lawyer said when he gave that interview that they had 300, or it might have been 3,000. See, now I don't remember, but usually when the number is so high, I have a hard time repeating it, because I think that sounds outrageous. But let's just say 300. They had, that's enough. They had 300 investigators, that's probably the number, working on this case. And all she had was him. He was saying, she has me, and they have 300 just investigators trying to, searching for evidence and stuff that they can use against her. And now, and the media, of course, has got everybody guilty, and they call them murderers and terrorists, and they've got it all done, even though it hasn't completely gone through court yet. And they act like, it's no question that these two guys were the murderers, and that she was helping them, and so she's an accessory, blah, blah, blah. The thing is, they were part of the right-wing scene, and they call them neo-Nazis. They probably are, they are national socialists. They are, they do call them, they are, people who are supportive of national socialism. And of course, that's not acceptable in Germany today. Okay, so then they say that they want to portray all this. They want to portray the right-wing scene as a serious danger to the peace of Germany, and the peacefulness and of the citizens and so on. Even though crime by Turks far outweighs any by Germans, I mean, there is a lot of crime by the Turks. But now they are constantly portraying the Turkish community as being victimized by the German right-wing community, which is so small and doesn't victimize, it doesn't have the power to do anything. Yet, and then they also take the position that it's the Germans' fault for not being welcoming enough to their Turkish visitors and immigrants, that if they were more welcoming, these people would do better, and they would integrate better, and so on. It's always the Germans' fault. Now, I want to point out here that in the 1980s, Turkish immigrants and laborers were concerned for all. And I mentioned in a previous show about Chancellor Helmut Kohl, German Chancellor Kohl, in 1982. That he had a plan to reduce the number of Turks living in Germany, like, by half. He wanted to reduce them by half. And he talked about this with Prime Minister Thatcher of Great Britain. And but he hadn't, it hadn't come out, you know, in the, to the public at that time, but it was something that he was working on privately. And it said, there was this document that has come out now that he said, I guess to Thatcher, that he wanted the Turks out. He said, Germany has no problems with the Portuguese, the Italians, or even the Southeast Asians, yuck. But that these communities integrated well, but the Turks came from a very distinctive culture and did not integrate well. I have an article on my site about how the Turkish people in Germany like being in Germany, but they don't want to give up their Turkish citizenship. And Germany does not allow you to have dual citizenship unless you're only for certain very special people. So, and they think that's unfair because they are so tied to the Turkish culture that they don't want to lose their Turkish passport. Well, now, you know, if they're so tied to the Turkish culture and they want to bring that Turkish culture and put it, you know, into Germany, and they're all Muslim too. Well, why don't they just go back to Turkey? Well, because it's so nice in Germany. It's so clean. It's so well regulated. There's so many opportunities. There's more money. There's everything. It's nice living around Germans. In spite, and you can even characterize them as being hateful people, and they won't even get mad at you for it. Now, Kohl had said that those who were to be integrated must learn German. Well, there's always this thing. I don't agree with any of this, but here's the thing that I'm not going to go through all this. He had this plan, and the fact is that in 1973, 12 years after signing the immigration agreement with Ankara, the capital of Turkey, they agreed on stopping recruitment in Turkey. Yet the number of Turks in Germany continued to rise because women and children joined their male heads of household. And after a coup in Ankara, more and more people applied for asylum. So by 1982, around 1.5 million Turks were living in Germany, and the country had its own, the Turks had their own problems, and there was a second oil crisis in the early 80s, and the German economy began to slump at rates not seen since World War II. In 1982, 1.8 million people were unemployed, six times more than in 1973. So the situation in 82 was much worse than in 73. And German citizens began to see immigrants as burdens on the social welfare system and competitors for jobs that were rightfully theirs. See, they were able to have that attitude then. You know, they knew that this was their country and this was their welfare system. And these jobs were jobs they were supposed to have. And now they are competing with the Turks, and, you know, there was all this unemployment, huge amount of unemployment. So at that point, a poll was taken, and 58% of Germans wanted to reduce the number of foreigners in the country. And the politicians in Bonn didn't like all those Turks. They wanted to get rid of them, but they didn't know how. They didn't know how to do it. Well, you know, when you start things like this, it's easy to bring people in and very hard to get them back out again. But nobody ever thinks about that, do they? Unfortunately. And now, today, well, anyway, Kohl never did carry out his plan to get rid of half of the Turks because he didn't have the political guts to do it either. And now, today, Germany is being accused by the EU, the European Union, of violating the law with language tests for certain immigrants, and the European Commission is looking into the matter. Well, the German politicians say the test isn't that hard. See, Germans are still, to some degree, trying to keep their country from being destroyed and keep it German. And they're saying that if certain immigrants need to take a language test, so that they know at least basic German before they can be allowed in. And some of these are those who are joining their spouses, you know, their wives and children of these men who are there working or running their little shops. But according to the European Union, having them pass a language test is unfair. Uh-oh. So that's, you know, what we deal with. So now continuing with the story about the NSU, the Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, also known as the BFV in German language, that's the acronym for it, had knowledge of the suspected NSU culprits since the 1990s. Okay, they knew about these guys because I have a story on my site that they had gone to check something and of Uwe Bonhart, and he was living, you know, with his parents, and they went early in the morning and got him out of bed and had him go across the street to where they parked their car in a garage and open it up for them so they could search the car and search the garage and so on. And then they had him go to another garage and search there, and where he had his car, that was his parents' car, was in the other one, and they were searching there, and then they he left in the car. They allowed him to do that. He drove off in his car, that was the end of, that's when he went underground, because he felt that they were harassing him too much and they weren't going to leave him alone, and they were looking for explosives. They thought they were, they say they found explosives, but at this time I didn't see anything that they didn't say that they found anything. They let him go. If they found explosives, why would they have let him go and drive off? Doesn't make any sense. But anyway, things have happened, like the head of the BFV resigned in the summer of 2012 after it came out that important files had been destroyed in his agency, allegedly without his knowledge. But here's the thing. These files, they assume that these were files that showed that agents of the, you know, Office for the Protection of the Constitution were collaborating too much with the right wing or something, and so they destroyed these files, which would have revealed that. But it doesn't say, you know, I mean, these files may have been exculpatory of the NSU, and that's why they were destroyed. Maybe they worked in favor of the NSU, and so they destroyed them, and then they had this guy resign to make it look good. And then he's, you know, still gets his pay and so on. Who knows? There have been, and then they say in this one story, there have been some signs of true compassion. This is to portray Germans as compassionless, you know, cold, uncaring, Nazi-type Germans. They don't have any compassion for these emotional, super-feeling Turks and Greeks. And so in this case, they say that Barbara John, who is that Jewess, Barbara John has been appointed by the German government as an advocate to look after the relatives' needs. She used to be in charge of migration affairs in Berlin. She's all about immigration. And now she's been put in charge of being, you know, of assistance to the Turkish families, the victims, not just for their emotional needs, but for filing material claims such as victims' pensions, and, you know, helping them get as much money out of this as they can get. Then they talk about, she talks about growing racism. Well, naturally, she's the Jew on hand here. And she says, she's unsatisfied with what's been done. Together with the chairman of Germany, chairman of the Turkish community of Germany, Kenan Kolat. So she gets together with this Turkish leader in Germany, and says that what's necessary now is that together they say what's necessary now is a change of mentality in Germany. And so this Turk speaks of growing racism in Germany and has called for the dissolution of the BFV, the Office for the Protection of the Constitution, federal office. It's a threat, he says, to the democratic state of law in Germany. Now, all the anti-fascists, I discovered, are calling for the abolition of this office because they think it's too supportive of the right wing. You know, it's there to protect the Constitution, and the Constitution says that Germany is a democratic state, and everybody is allowed to express themselves and so on. But these people don't want that. This Turkish leader, this Jewish woman, and all these anti-fascists and anti-racists who are all over the place in Germany, and these anarchists and so on. They talk about democracy, but they don't want democracy. They want to destroy any right-wing existence, any kind of nationalism. Anybody who's nationalist, they want them absolutely banned from having any say in anything. So all this was taking place before the trial ever began, you know. And when the trial began, it didn't start until May of this year. It was supposed to start in January, but it was put off for all these problems that come up for them. And they've been in session since May. So it's May, June, July. And then they've taken the month of August off for summer vacation. Or, you know, they have to have their holidays. And their holidays are always a month long, especially the summer one. And so in 3 months, they have been in session for 32 days. So, you know, They're not there all the time. They're not having this court meet all the time like we do here in the United States. Because we have juries, and we can't leave the jury hanging around for a year. But they can go on for 2 years there because they don't have a jury. They have something that's called, normal people from the community, two representatives there or something. But, you know, they just come when they're supposed to come, and they don't come. It doesn't matter because they're never in seclusion or anything, and then they don't have to worry about what they read either in the papers. That somehow doesn't come into anybody's, doesn't make a problem for anyone. So now here's the thing. What have they got? As I asked before, where are the bicycles? I've not heard a word about those bicycles. You know, there was in the trial so far, they've had a witness come, they presented evidence for the murder of the last one, this Simsek guy, he's the flower seller. I can't think of his first name. And there's one witness, and he is a guy who was driving by in his car, and he, down the street where that guy's flower seller place was set up. I think it moves around. But, he heard some noises, he said, some loud noises. Then he saw two men run out from that little hut or trailer thing, and he thought they were dressed in biking clothes. And he said something about a hat with one, but then later he said he wasn't sure about that. He just saw two men run out and run away. They ran away. They didn't get on bicycles or anything. They ran off, and he just kept driving, I guess. But they found him, and that's what he can testify to, that two guys ran out of that place on the day that the murder took place, after he heard those noises. And the only other thing they ever mentioned is that they have a gun. You know, they have this Seska pistol, which they say is the one that was used, and it was found in that house. So then, finally, this German foreign minister, Guido Westerwelle, who's homosexual, said that if he's still there, I'm not sure if he's still there either, said that this trial will influence and in some regions even shape the image that Germany has in the world, which is what they're concerned about. And so, you know, in the Germans' mind, they're doing all this because they have to find these people guilty, or Germany will look bad. If they, you know, they've come up with this and now they've gone so far with it, they have to find these people guilty. But it's just amazing to think how they're going to prove any kind of guilt in this trial, considering what they've done so far, which is they've had a year, they spent over a year investigating and putting it all together, and now they've had 32 days of court session, and what they've come up with is pretty weak, you know, but who knows what they have coming up. But nobody is saying that they have any great stuff in store. And they had this march, you know, ahead of the trial. This is more of the show and the pretense and so on that they do. There was this big march in Munich, and it was put on by the in support of the victims' families and so on. It was made up of Turks and anti-fascists and all these kind of people. And there was this song sung by a rap group called a German-Turkish-Italian rap group. Home is a feeling and not a country, were the words in the song. You know, and see, there you go. Home is a feeling and not a country. No, home is a country. Unless you want to be at home in somebody else's country, then you might say that. But you're not at home unless you're there. You're not at home in your mind. You're just imagining it. You know, it's just silly. It's just silly. So, and this whole thing was set up because they had commercially printed signs and a bunch of Turkish people and then a bunch of German people who would have been these anarchists and so on and other types. And it was all organized. So these organizers let me say this. Then they marched. They marched through Munich. And it says it was a five-hour protest route through historic squares that recall past attacks by Nazis, including Königsplatz and Odeonsplatz. And it also made its way around the central train station, passing countless Turkish and Greek businesses. So they were allowed to go on a five-hour march, and that stirred people up. Yet when nationalists want to hold a public march, say in Dresden, you know, they're not allowed to, and the anti-fascists are allowed to attack them and go after them and stop the march, and they block them and so on, and then it's all called off. So that's my show for tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry, I have to say goodnight. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.